In this episode of the Smart City Podcast, I had a super awesome chat with robotics and artificial intelligence guru, Michael Milford. Michael is a professor at QUT and has his own startup, Math Thrills. Michael and I talk about some of the cool things he's working on at the moment and the different aspects of autonomous vehicles and AI, artificial intelligence. We also have great discussion about keeping and attracting local talent and had a pleasantly unexpected convo about the importance of diversity in the tech space. I really enjoyed this Friday afternoon chat, and I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
It's the Smart City Podcast, whoa, with Smart City experts, here we go. Connecting smart technology, both big and small. Smart cities are making life better for all. Big data, emerging trends, self-driving cars and more. The Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hi, Michael. How are you going this afternoon?
Hi, Zoe. It's great to be on your podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for coming. Thanks for agreeing to coming on to the Smart City Podcast. I'm really excited about our conversation. Well, the conversation that we're going to have. No pressure.
No pressure at all. It's Friday afternoon, so not too much pressure.
Yeah, I am actually drinking wine, so just FYI.
Oh, so you have the advantage. That's a bit unfair, really.
Hey, I'm in my home office. Anything goes around here.
True. That's true.
Cool. Well, let's just jump straight into it. And can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're passionate about?
Sure. So I'm Brisbane born and bred. I grew up and did all my schooling and university education in Brisbane. I went to university here. I went to the University of Queensland, did a PhD there in robotics. Stuck around and then moved to QUT, where I am now. I've been there for about 7 or 8 years now. And I'm passionate about a number of things, but two of the main things that I'm really interested in and passionate around, I guess, all things to do with artificial intelligence and robotics. So that's what my role at QUT is all about, sort of pushing the boundaries on researching various aspects of those technology fields. And trying to translate it into actual applications in the real world so people can actually get some use out of these technologies. And the other thing I'm really passionate about is education and outreach. So ever since I left school, I've been writing books for kids that try and demystify mathematics, science, and technology. And we sort of expanded that range. I have a startup company called Math Thrills now, which has a whole range of sort of books that are trying to make STEM and maths and other sort of traditionally considered boring things a little bit more exciting and engaging for kids of all ages.
Yeah, awesome. So I'm going to presume that you're interested in smart cities before I ask this question, but what sparked your interest in smart cities?
A number of things. So I guess cities for the last century, I guess, have had this reputation as sort of, to many people, sort of static, unchanging concrete sort of jungles. And I think with all the technology that's starting to come on board now in terms of drones, in terms of big data, in terms of artificial intelligence, and of course, in terms of autonomous vehicles and intelligent transport, I think it's going to be really fascinating to see how radically the very concept of what a city is and what a smart city will become with all of these very exciting, but also very much still in development technologies. And I think it's really interesting and challenging to sort of be involved in that discussion and trying to shape how it all occur, especially in places like Australia. Obviously, I have a vested interest because that's where I live and that's where my family is growing up. So we'd like to have smart cities that are really nice places and advanced places for our kids to grow up in.
Yeah, definitely. So are there any particular technologies that you've come across that you're really interested in exploring?
So the two technologies I mentioned briefly before that I'm particularly interested in are autonomous vehicle technology. Obviously, most cities, some form of intelligent transport or autonomous vehicle transport is probably, although not certainly, going to factor in a big way in sort of redesigning what the smart city of the future looks like. It's interesting for a number of reasons. I guess the first reason is that it has the potential to actually save lives, and that would be an incredibly amazing outcome for a technology, especially if they're rolled out en masse and they save thousands, if not millions of lives. That would be absolutely incredible. It's really interesting from an intellectual and scientific perspective because it's a really challenging problem to make a vehicle that can navigate a city as competently and as reliably and as safely as a good human driver. And you can see that, especially in light of recent events, the large companies who have a lot of the top people in the world and hundreds of billions of dollars of resource behind them, even for them, it's a challenging problem. So I guess that's driving a lot of my interest in staying involved in autonomous vehicles. And I guess the other area that really interests me about Start Cities is the amount of data that you'll be able to collect on all aspects of how the city operates, how the people in the city move around, and how you can combine that data or big data with various developing, I guess, artificial intelligence-based technologies to infer new insights about how a city works and about how a city doesn't work, and use those insights to, I guess, not only shape day-to-day operation and logistics of the city, but also the long-term development of what a city will look like in 10 or 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, cool. I know you're working on some of those technologies at the moment, so let's jump into that. What are some of the projects and things that you're working on right now?
So I'm directly involved in a couple of projects which are pretty relevant, I think, to what we've just been chatting about. So one of them is a more technological project. So we work with the Queensland government through their Advanced Queensland scheme, through a tech company called Mining 3 and through a Fortune 100 mining equipment provider called Caterpillar, which operates all around the world. And we're working on using some of the, I guess, robotic technology that we've been developing at QUT in our Australian Centre for Robotic Vision, developing that technology and deploying it to enable or improve the capability of the autonomous underground mining vehicles that operate in mines, not only in Australia, but all around the world. There's a few reasons for that. One is if you can make the vehicles more efficient and more reliable and able to operate at higher speeds, you can save a lot of money and you can keep an industry competitive, which means you don't have job loss. Also the safety aspects. So there's an old adage with robotics that dull, dirty, and dangerous jobs are the jobs where robotics has the biggest role to play. And underground mining, while there is a lot of safety and regulation, it's still fundamentally a somewhat dangerous environment. So if we can remove people from harm's way and replace it with robotics and automation, that's a good thing as well. The other project that we're just starting to work on is working with Transport and Main Roads, with the Queensland government, looking at how to understand what impact autonomous vehicles will have as they're eventually introduced to Australia at a large scale. And one of the projects we're particularly looking at is the interaction of all the different scenarios of autonomous vehicle technology with current and perhaps future infrastructure that we have in our cities. One of the challenges of governments and infrastructure providers, of course, is that infrastructure investments are very much long-term bets. They're sort of 20 or 30-year bets. And that's very hard to sort of make decisions about when you have all this uncertainty regarding what autonomous vehicles are going to do, what the technology is going to look like, how good they're going to be, and how much they're going to interact with the infrastructure. So what we're trying to do is paint, I guess, a vision of the most likely scenarios based on all the information we have and our expertise in this area so that we can give, I guess, Australia a playbook for how to respond or even proactively get ahead of the game in terms of introducing autonomous vehicles and making changes to infrastructure in cities.
Yeah, that all sounds like really interesting work and I think really relevant work too. Do you think that Brisbane is a really good place to pilot this sort of technology?
Yeah, so Brisbane's pretty great and it's changed a lot even over the last few years. I think most people have noticed that it's a very modern, relatively affluent city. Most of the infrastructure is relatively fresh and new. So I think it's a good place to do some of these pilot trials around autonomous vehicles and related technology. It's also potentially a great stepping board for actually doing some of the core technology development here. Brisbane's entrepreneurial scene has exploded over the last two or three years through a lot of very influential people sort of driving the field forward and a lot of investment from the government and other parties. So you could see, as well as being a great place to test this technology, it may be a great place to even do some of the research and development around this technology. One of the founders of Atlassian recently bemoaned that we tend to export talent rather than products and technology because a lot of our talent just goes straight overseas. It would be nice if we can set up an environment in Brisbane and in other Australian cities where people are more tempted to stay around and actually develop some of the core technology here. It already happens, but not very often.
Yeah, definitely. Are you really interested in kind of nourishing that talent here in Brisbane?
Yes. So I have a lot of selfish and also sort of more lofty reasons to be interested in it. So selfishly, we've lost a lot of our colleagues and our students to overseas companies because there's obviously great opportunities overseas working with some of these big tech giants, corporates, and as well as startups. And obviously there's a lot of money to be earned as well, but it's not just about the money. It's also the opportunities people have overseas. It would be nice if we can convince some of those people to come back. And it'd be nice if we can convince some of the people to actually start in Australia and stay in Australia and actually have a go at doing startups and development here. There's nothing wrong with brain drain per se, as long as some of the people who go overseas do come back and sort of share their wisdom and experience. But at the moment, it feels like it's a little bit one-way traffic. So providing some critical mass in these areas and providing some really exciting projects and initiatives and centers that really capture the imagination of the public, I think are going to be really key to nourishing that local talent development and retention.
Yeah, no, I agree. Are there any other particular things that you think Brisbane or even Australia can do or is doing that draws draws the talent in and keeps it there?
So I think there's a lot of things. So speaking just selfishly about Brisbane versus other cities in Australia, one thing that's very apparent about Brisbane is that it is significantly cheaper overall to live and perhaps raise a family in Brisbane than it is in Sydney, definitely, and to a lesser extent even in Melbourne. So Brisbane itself has a great appeal from that perspective. Some people like the weather in Brisbane better as well as the access to beaches. I think in general, Australia, from everything I've heard, is considered to be a great place to live, very nice place to bring up a family with lots of natural environments to go visit on the weekend. The main problem is that people perceive is just that we're so isolated from everyone else. One of the big disappointments, I think, of the last 50 or 60 years in terms of technology is fundamentally coming from America to here 20 or 30 years ago is really not that much different to what it is now. Perhaps the airplane seats are cheaper, perhaps they're slightly more comfortable, but it's still a horrendous experience which takes many, many hours. So coming up with better ways to, I guess, telecommute and collaborate with people overseas in terms of, I guess, advanced teleconferencing technology and other things like cheaper international travel. Perhaps Elon Musk can develop his 1 or 2 hour ballistic missile sort of trip over to the States and solve all our problems. But before that happens, I think just trying to make it as easy and as seamless as possible for us to work with our colleagues in America and in Europe and in Asia, that will be a big plus. I think Asia has the appeal of there's no time zone difference, which is a massive advantage. Even if you could get really good travel to the States or to Europe, you'd still have to deal with the time zone differences. Asia is attractive in that you don't have to do that. And of course, China is leading the way with a lot of its technology development. So building our relationships with those countries, I think, will be important as well.
Yeah, you make some really valid points there. I think when I was in South Korea, not having a time, well, we had a 1 hour time difference. That was just so incredible to be able to talk to people in real time, I guess. But dealing with people in the States or in the UK, that time difference really is a killer because you've only got a couple of hours that you're both awake, basically. So I think Asia definitely is a real key player with Australia in that space.
The only advantage of America and Europe that we sometimes find is if you are jointly working on a project, you can do 12-hour shifts without overlapping at all. So you can have someone always working on the project. You just shuttle the project back and forth between the two continents. But that's not enough to make up for all the shortcomings of the time difference, I don't think.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a good point too. I think that the telecommuting is definitely a key factor and probably one we don't talk about enough. Even just in Australia, like if a project in Brisbane really wants somebody that's currently in Sydney and they're happy working in there, that shouldn't need to be a barrier in getting the best talent for the project.
Yeah. If you want to talk about like technologies that have been hyped for decades and decades and have just consistently disappointed people, I think teleconferencing-based technology is an example. So there are exceptions, right? So there are high-profile corporate companies which have dedicated conference rooms that are pretty reliable and pretty seamless in experiences. But that's still not the same as physically being there in person. I had a really illuminating example of this. I went on sabbatical to Boston for 6 months a few years ago. And just physically sitting in the same office area as other people, I was just constantly getting fed all sorts of amazing informal tidbits of information and stuff like that. When I came back home, I still had good teleconferencing, I had phone calls, I had email, but that ad hoc informal stream of really useful information just disappeared overnight. And we don't have technology like chat on our phones is okay, but it's still nowhere near as natural as just mentioning something to someone 3 meters away. So I think that's something we can work on. I think things like Google Glass and other technologies have attempted to solve some of these things, but we're still a long way from something that's as naturalistic as just being in the same room as a person.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point too. I think that the more and more we get comfortable with telecommuting, then the more and more important those face-to-face conversations really become. So, you know, 90% of your interaction might be online, but that 10% that you get with the person just becomes so much more valuable. But, yeah, we haven't quite worked out how, you know, that person working at home can still be involved in those ad hoc conversations, which, as you mentioned, are really important.
Yeah.
So where do you think that Australia kind of ranks when it comes to smart cities?
I think in terms of intent and in terms of the amount of resources and activity going on in the space, I think we rank pretty well. Like, I think most of the state governments, local governments, and even the federal government are pretty much aware of the potential challenges and also opportunities in the smart city space. I think where we do naturally lag a little bit behind is smart cities will, in large part, not entirely, but in large part, will be facilitated by bleeding edge new technologies and effective deployment of these technologies. And that's where we do miss out, I think, in a large part, because we don't have the large corporations and startups and tech corporates who are developing that technology sort of embedded in all of our major cities. So we do have sort of nodes of some of the major sort of top 100 tech companies in Sydney and in Melbourne and in Brisbane, but often they're primarily sales staff rather than the actual core developers. And I think that sort of introduces a bit of a different dynamic to what it would be like if you're trying to do a smart city in Palo Alto or something in California.
Yeah, definitely. So how do you think we can better integrate across the different disciplines, the governments, the universities and industries?
So from what I've seen, the government's been doing the right thing across Australia by very proactively trying to play catch-up ball and sort of get at least on a level footing with understanding all the new technologies that are coming out. And I think they've been reasonably successful with that. In order to sort of try and get ahead of the technologies, I think we need to be very much, until we get a lot of R&D happening here, I think we need to really be plugged into what's happening overseas. And you can only get that through people who have regular connections, regular trips with all of these key players overseas. And I think those people need to play a key role in keeping, all these stakeholders in Australia informed as to the most recent developments, many of which are sort of happening behind the scenes and you won't hear about them publicly until 2 or 3 years down the track. And those 2 or 3 years are critical. If you can start responding or planning for a new technology advance 2 or 3 years earlier, that gives you a much better sort of starting platform than if you're sort of just playing catch up.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Do you think that Australia can become leaders in this space?
I think we definitely have the capability to become leaders in aspects of this space. We already train many of the best people in the world, and we know that because our top talent is in constant demand and is constantly streaming overseas in some of these really topical fields. So we don't need to make any assertions there. We know that's already the status quo. As we discussed earlier, I think we need to come up with increasingly effective ways to retain or attract back some significant fraction of that talent as a sort of regularly occurring things. One of the big problems, I think, in Australia is cultural. So cultural change is very hard to enact, and it's very slow typically. And you see through students at schools, even before they get to university, a lot of attitudes about entrepreneurialism, about doing startups, about tech innovation have already pretty much been set in stone. You can see all the things in terms of unconscious bias and gender-based differences in attitudes towards STEM, and some of those get baked in as early as like 5 or 6 years old. So I think we can work a lot on changing people's perceptions of opportunities in this space and the ups and downs of working in the space, and starting that at a very early age. And there's a lot of good people doing that. There's a lot of people working on sort of programs for girls, programs to introduce entrepreneurialism into young kids, but it's still sort of ad hoc and lots of different players. There's not sort of any really good universal permanent sort of scheme to make sure that these that we're sort of updating education to match the realities of a modern world.
Yeah, no, that's a really good kind of way to think about it. And I think that STEM in schools, and particularly women in engineering and tech, is still underrepresented. And I think the way that you change that is by not necessarily focusing on women in engineering, or female engineers, as we're called sometimes these days. It's actually that school-based approach where you're making role models, or you're showing role models of all different varieties. I don't want to use varieties for human beings, but all different makes and models, which again, probably don't want to use that for human beings. But I found, like, as a young woman, there weren't many role models for me. I didn't know any female engineers. However, I was pretty keen to go against the grain, so that's why I chose engineering. But I think what you're talking about, and like I know in your books, because I've got one in particular, that not just gender but race and all those other things, that diversity, what is important in diversity, is shown in your book, so everyone, no matter who's reading it, can have a role model. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, and the role models, one of the problems with a lot of the I'll probably get crucified for saying this, but one of the problems, and I've seen this happen time and time again, was that some of the early role models for, say, gender inclusivity were role models who were not, I guess, normal people. These were people who were incredibly driven and would succeed at pretty much no matter what obstacles were thrown at them. And that's inspiring in a way, but it's also confronting, because not everyone is like that, right? Whether they're male or female. I think having role models who are also a little bit more perhaps relatable, and also role models who are just role models, not through being exceptional, but just through doing interesting stuff and it no longer being a special thing. It's just a normal thing. I think that's hopefully somewhere we can get to. But yes, the subtle things like what you read, what you see on TV, what you see in entertainment, is incredibly powerful when you sort of look at all of the consumption that we do on a daily basis. So that's why we really try, for example, in our books, to make sure everything's as inclusive as possible, not just with respect to gender or where you came from, but also in terms of ability, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. No, I really enjoy your book. So I got one because I was part of the Kickstarter campaign. And
yes, and very much appreciate that. That was very, very nice of you to support it.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to plug myself on my own podcast, but I'm giving that book to my sister who's having a baby. So she'll have a little engineer on her hands.
Great. Our next one, which we're just about to make public as a campaign, is called My Daughter's Name is Rachel, and the book is called Rachel Rocketeer, and it's basically a very young female version of Elon Musk developing her own space program to get to Mars. So that's really exciting.
That's awesome. I was watching The Martian the other day, and I'm really inspired to go to Mars now and be an astronaut. So
yeah, that's an incredibly inspiring movie, I think.
You've mentioned Elon Musk twice now, and I must say that he's my next person that I want to get on the podcast. So,
yep.
Reach for the stars.
We were just discussing this with someone else today. He's come to Australia. He's aware of Australia, which is already a big step up from a lot of international superstars. So, I'd say give it a go.
Yep. Hey, you can only say no so many times before you say yes, right?
That's true.
You never know until you ask. So, yeah, Elon, if you're listening to this, reach out to me, but I'll probably reach out to you first. Okay, I do have another question. What are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about at the moment?
Oh, that's tough. That's like the trillion-dollar question, right?
Yep.
I think one of the trends, it's not a trend. I think it's an observation. And that is with all these things like STEM, AI, there are a lot of strong, and I could be accused of this just as anyone else could be. There's a lot of vested interests, right? So there's people who are hyping up all of these new things and saying they're going to be a panacea, cure-all for everything. And there's also these sort of pessimists who say it's never going to happen. We're never going to have autonomous cars. There's going to be another AI winter and technology is going to go backwards. I think one of the trends or maybe observations that I would make is that even if 90% of what you hear about in the media is hype, the 10% that's actually true is enough to actually transform society. And the transformations won't necessarily be like Skynet-based Terminator robots or human-level intelligence. You can really transform society with just lots of steady incremental improvements in these technologies like AI. And I think that's quietly happening at a steady rate, sort of behind the scenes. You sort of pick up bits and pieces of it in the news, but I think that's really going to be the defining sort of thing of this sort of decade period starting now. And unless someone happens to make an incredible breakthrough in artificial intelligence, I think it will just be this period of steady incremental progress, steady changes, steady impact on society and industry and how we work. And if you add up all those changes over the next 10 years, it's going to add up to a lot of change.
Yeah. No, I really like that. I know that you said once in one of the conferences or something that you were speaking at autonomous vehicles, that's really exciting for the fact that they're autonomous vehicles, but what we might get from that is near human level AI. So I really liked that kind of take on it because that's the first time I'd kind of heard that.
Yeah, and the thing I'd like to, the point I make about that is with self-driving cars, for example, initially a lot of people and startups, maverick startups are going, oh, we're going to train these self-driving cars just like humans do, and they're going to watch humans drive and they're going to learn how to drive from humans. And then I think there was a bit of a backlash to that. And then there was a lot of sort of more conventional, traditional engineering approaches, sort of using formal control theory and all this more rigorous sort of theoretical approaches to address it. And I guess the point I was trying to make there was that the jury is still out on whether when we eventually get to cars that drive as well as or better than humans, will they be able to do that while still being relatively dumb, highly engineered systems? Or will people who manage to develop that level of capability, whether they set out to do it or not, they may not have set out to do it this way, will they inadvertently develop something which has all the aspects of an actual intelligent agent? I think that's a really fascinating question, and that's, I guess, scientifically why I'm particularly interested in driving self-driving cars.
Yeah, no, I really like that point of view. And whether, you know, it eventuates or not, it's definitely, scientifically very interesting to see that.
And one of the other things I think is really important, and there's all this, like you see this reaction to AI and people will make these absolute statements, and the easiest way to be proven wrong is to make an absolute statement. And the most common absolute statement is, okay, AI and robots, they're gonna automate a lot of these jobs, but they'll never, ever, ever replace a teacher's job or replace any jobs that have any sort of emotional component whatsoever. Now, those are very hard problems. They're problems which we may not feel comfortable with a robot or a human doing, but saying that it will never happen or you'll never be able to develop a system that isn't at least useful in that role is I think, a bit of a stretch. And I think what people think about when they're making these statements is, they're thinking about the award-winning psychologist who is incredibly effective in communicating with humans and helping them through their problems. But the automation and AI is going to start to assist in sort of low-level roles where it's someone who you have a 30-second interaction with. It's not particularly emotionally perceptive of an interaction. And those sort of things, there's much potential for AI and automation becoming more significant in sort of these processes. So I think making these absolute statements that things will never, ever happen are potentially even dangerously misleading.
Yeah. It's been so great to talk to you, Michael, this afternoon. I always find it insightful every time we have a discussion.
Which we'll need to do again off the record.
Yes, definitely. I just have one last question, which is how can people connect with you?
Oh, sure. So if you're interested in robotics and AI, you can just look me up. I'm a professor at QUT, so you can find my name and email address plastered all over the internet. If you're interested in sort of STEM and education and all that sort of stuff, I have a startup company called Math Thrills. There's a website around it. We have a store. I have a Twitter handle at Math Thrills. So you can contact me that way as well. And we're always happy to talk.
Yeah, awesome. I'll put everything, all the links and everything in the show notes so people can connect with you. And yeah, thanks again so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thanks for the great questions and we'll chat again soon.
Definitely.
It's the Smart City Podcast. Whoa.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart City Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes can be found at thesmartcitypodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for me or any of my guests, connect with me via email, zoe@thesmartcitypodcast.com, or via the socials. I'm on Twitter and Facebook at Smart City Pod. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.